Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Today I'm pleased to have with me Dr. Robert Forman, who is the author of Enlightenment, Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. This is a great book for people who are on the spiritual path, one that is brutally honest, and one that I really enjoyed reading. Dr. Larry Dossey says that Robert is one of the premier spiritual teachers of our time, so I thought we'd get started and find out how Robert got on the spiritual path. Hello, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be with you.
Yes, you're calling from New York, is that right?
Yeah, and you're in Atlanta, as I recall.
Yes, same time zone. Very, very convenient. Sometimes when the author's in Hawaii, it's not so they're not so much awake. Anyway, I understand you you started out in transcendental meditation, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what happened from there?
Well, you asked me how you began by saying, wondered how we got started on the path. My path started in a serious depression. I was very depressed when I was in my early 20s. And meditation, transcendental meditation, came to me really as a gift. It was not the first thing I tried, but it was the first thing that really seemed to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started meditation, and I went to a 9-month meditation retreat after a couple of years, and I found it was just a wonderful experience and something I just has really did change my life. And it was there that the experience that I describe in the book began. So is that something you'd like me to talk about, or?
Well, I just wanted to mention to the authors that probably transcendental meditation was the beginning of this the spiritual path in the Western world anyway, and they've done a great deal of really good research into the health benefits and social benefits and all sorts of benefits of meditation.
Yeah,
I just wanted to acknowledge that they have really probably changed the spiritual path of this country. So
yeah, I think so.
It's a good start, not
and
bad
the
at
TM,
all.
The TM path has been fairly well researched. There's a lot of research these days being done on Buddhism as well. And I think you're right. I think the research that was done and the efforts that were done by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi many years ago really got the Eastern meditation path, Eastern religions, Eastern approach to spirituality kind of into the Western vocabulary. So yeah, it had a huge impact on the society.
And probably the Maharishi was one of the first spiritual masters that the American was introduced to,
yeah,
and one that had a pretty tremendous influence on a lot of the authors. You mentioned Ram Dass in your book, and other leaders had.
Yeah, I've interviewed probably about 1,000 spiritual leaders and teachers and writers for a project I've been involved in, and TM was certainly one of the most popular among spiritual teachers and leaders. A lot of people started TM and then went on to something else. Many people started TM and have continued to do it. That's been my path. I've added some things to it, but TM has remained my path. I've continued meditating now without missing a day for some 42 years.
That's fabulous. That is. So, but you kind of found a chink in the armor of TM when you were at Columbia studying comparative religions. Would you like to share that with our audience?
Sure. It was not only a chink in the armor of TM, it was a chink in the armor of any naive religious path.
Right,
and that is
exactly.
That I think that it's easy to be to become a kind of true believer in a particular path and to think,
mm-hmm,
this is absolutely true and this is the only way to think. And what I discovered by studying the nature of religious life. I got a PhD in the study of religion, and in the process,
mm-hmm,
of doing that, I really had to come to terms with the fact that every religious system teaches you how to think, teaches you what's true, but if you start stepping back from any one religious system, you realize that they all have a certain version of the truth or a certain way to think about the,
mm-hmm,
truth. But it becomes impossible to say any one path has the whole story, any one path has the complete truth. And when I went back to my TM buddies and I said, we have a wonderful teaching, but it's not the only way to think, people were quite upset with me, and people thought I was,
mm-hmm,
I was saying TM didn't work, and they thought I was saying Maharishi was wrong, and that's not at all it. It's rather that I think to be a grown-up these days in a very polycultural world, we really have to come to terms with the fact that there's lots of good ways to think and that they all have something of value in the core of them. And so that to think any one path is the only way, I think is just naive, and I think it's dangerous. It leads to fundamentalism, and it leads to thinking that everybody has to think your way, and that, I think, is just plain dangerous. And that's what I had to come to terms with.
I had the impression, I also studied comparative religion and felt that it might be where you are in your spiritual development, which lesson you're learning most, what's at the forefront. Is forgiveness at the forefront? Maybe Christianity is your path. Is, you know, obedience? Maybe Judaism then. You know, each religion emphasized a little bit a different area of the lessons we have to learn, in this lifetime.
That's a nice way to think about it. The way I think about it is that, in a funny way, I think a path chooses us, as opposed to us choosing a path. I mean, in
my
own life, and I suspect this is true for you, but in my own life, I tried Zen, I tried yoga, I tried psychotherapy, mm-hmm. I tried studying psychology, but it was really TM that just sort of went, hit me on the head like a hammer. It was
mm-hmm.
just powerful for me. And I've taught probably 1,000 people how to meditate, and I'd say 5-10% have continued beyond a year. I mean, it didn't work for many people, and it worked
right.
for some people.
Right.
And I think probably pretty much every path is a little like that, that some paths work quite well for this person and not so well for that person. And for some weird reason, TM has always been especially effective for me, and it's always been powerful. But I've added to it psychotherapy and marriage counseling and training in psychology. And so I've added quite a number of pieces to it. But it's always remained the sort of bulwark of my life.
And there's a difference between the meditation, which you can take out of TM, which you've done, and using it as the only, worldview that you acknowledge.
That's
very different.
Right. It's a way to think about it. So that, and I think, my students, I teach college, and my mm-hmm. students often say to me, well, what's your religious, what's your religion? And I say, mm-hmm. I consider myself a deeply religious man, but I'm not affiliated. And I think that's sort of true for many of us. There's a huge and growing percentage of people that are deeply committed to their spiritual lives and deeply committed to their sense of something bigger in their lives and something bigger in the world, and yet don't find any one path or any one view or worldview in what you're saying to be complete enough or whole enough. And I think there's a lot of us in this boat.
I have kind of the whole range of things. I remember as a teenager, I had a book called Super Consciousness Through Meditation. I don't remember who wrote it, but the concepts were fascinating. But I also tried to be agnostic. I became a very good agnostic until I was in college, and I had my guardian angel actually appeared in my room in the physical or whatever dimension I was in. I'm not sure, but I actually had a direct encounter with my guardian angel, which, of course, blew atheism and being agnostic out of the water. That doesn't work when you have those kind of experiences. And
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
Well, one thing that's been really fun about writing this book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, is the conversations I've gotten into with people afterwards. And quite a number of people have said to me that there's a certain kind of truthfulness, a kind of honesty, and quite a number of people have used the word courage when they describe it. And one
mm-hmm.
person in particular described herself as an agnostic until she read the book. And I said, why? And she said, because I've begun to realize that my own agnosticism was a way to avoid the harder questions as opposed to being courageous. There was a certain kind of cowardice in the middle of my agnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a little more courage to at least say to yourself, there may be something more in the world. There might be something more in my life than I knew. And it takes a certain amount of courage to accept that or to acknowledge it, even if you don't know what to call it, even if you don't know the implication about the whole thing. I think it takes a certain kind of strength to be able to say, yes, I recognize there is more in the world than what we know. So I compliment you for recognizing and for acknowledging what was in that space with you.
ask. Well, thank you. I think basically I went on from there to study many different religions, as I'm sure you did too, and it struck me that all religions have at their core the same thing, and your book describes that thing very well. So, you know, it's not a belief. It is glimpses at probably who we really are. Who, when I say we, I don't just mean humans either. It's what's behind every living thing that we all share in common. That you said in your book that, you know, the masters would sit on the podiums and talk about it, but you can't describe it to somebody. Somebody really has to experience it, and that's why meditation is important, because meditation is the one thing that will get you to experience it.
I think, yeah. And I used to think that all the religions were teaching the same thing, and I had to conclude they're not all teaching the same thing. Certainly not exactly. But I think what you're pointing to is very accurate. That is, though different religions are probably teaching different things, I think behind religious lives is the same sense of connection with, well, I like to call it the vastness, which is a pretty neutral thing, but a sense of connection with something larger than us, connection with something that's vast. There's a certain kind of openness I stumbled into when I was quite young with meditation, and a certain kind of spaciousness. And I think that sense of being connected to what's larger is at the core of the religious life. So I think I agree with you. I think that there is something that's consistent. Sometimes I see it in people when they talk about relationships. Sometimes I sense it in people when they talk about, you know, what it's like to go for a walk in the woods. It doesn't have to be in a church or a synagogue or even on a meditation mat. But I agree. I think meditation helps. And it's probably the only thing I know that relatively systematically helps. And so it is something I would recommend quite strongly, but there are other ways, and I've had to come to terms with that.
There are spiritual disciplines that, certain yoga disciplines, for example, Kundalini yoga, for example, is something that, and you probably shouldn't wander into either meditation or Kundalini yoga without a little bit of guidance, just because it can bring up some things that are, could be pretty scary, you know, if you do it without a guide.
I think a guide is good in this. And I think, I would say being in something of a community is very helpful because it keeps us going.
Oh, it is, yeah. Absolutely.
When we're sort of discouraged or when things don't seem to be developing. One of the difficulties with meditation is that for most people that pick it up, there's a long period relatively early on where things are changing very subtly and don't tend to see it. But if you keep meditating for the first, I don't know, 6 months or so, things start to change and you begin to be a little more sensible to what's actually been changing in your life. And I think that's important. So whatever it takes to keep you going for that first half year or year, I think it's very valuable.
Yeah, groups are really important. We meditate here in Atlanta 3 times a week with a meditation group, and it is a very important part of what we do here. Although we run a medical clinic that has surgery and all sorts of holistic integrative medicine, the core of what my life is in the meditation group.
Yeah, well, and I'm very also with what you do, trying to tie these two worlds together. So really off to you.
Well, thank you. I've had a lot of help. You know, every step of the way, even getting a radio show. You know, I've been interviewing people weekly for over 15 years, so you can imagine everybody I've interviewed, and I had my own television show for 6 years, so I actually met everybody. You know, I sat across the table from Ron Das, and he apologized when he thought plastic surgery was just cosmetic, and I had to explain to him, no, we actually do trauma, I just have met everybody in the spiritual consciousness movement. And you know what's very interesting? Many of them say that they were first, especially Deepak Chopra and Larry Dawsey both said that they were, opened up to this by a plastic surgeon who wrote a book called Psycho-Cybernetics. I don't know if you've ever read that one, but it was actually written by a plastic surgeon way before. I think it was in the 60s.
Well, I would say, and it's what I hear you sort of aiming at, I would say that what we're really after, and I don't think anybody quite has it yet, so I'm very open to a lot of different ways, but I think what we're really after is we're after transformed lives as a whole. not just mm-hmm. one side, not just the inner spiritual life, not just the outer life, not just the physical, not just the body. But I think what we're all after, and I think what we should be after as sane human beings, is a life that involves all the different pieces of our lives and brings the spirit, the depth of spirituality into our everyday relationships and into our bodies and into what we, you know, what we do for work. And I think what we're looking for is a complete life. It's a whole life. And so what yeah. you're doing, as I hear it, is you're attempting to connect the inner meditative life with the outer physiology and do it in a way that's both responsible and not culty. And I think that that's yeah. certainly what I'm after as well.
And if you want to be totally present with something, try doing surgery. You have to be yeah, present. It's very interesting. You can't be daydreaming. I mean, you're focused on one thing, which is what's right in front of you. But actually, being a surgeon, I've been a surgeon now for 30 years. Being a surgeon has helped me focus as much as meditation has. And I was guided to be a surgeon because I was headed in a totally different direction. So I think that if you follow your guidance, which actually is much more powerful if you are meditating, I believe. I think you understand your guidance better then. If you follow your guidance, then you will be led into the, you know, into the work, into the relationships, into the, you know, the practices that you need to be in order to solve the problems that are in front of you. You spoke about, you know, a problem with anxiety and a problem with depression, and you know, a large portion of the population deals with those problems. But instead of going a spiritual route and actually solving these problems, because you really did, most people just take Xanax or a SSRI inhibitor and don't get anywhere.
I think that's really a pity.
It really is.
As somebody that's gone through serious anxiety disorders and serious depression, at this point in my life, because I've looked at what was going on, I've really thought about it. My meditation's been helpful. I've done some inner work on this stuff. I consider my depression the best thing that ever happened to me at this point, because it was mm-hmm. it was my way to recognize where I was not telling the truth about who I was, where I was mm-hmm. at a distance from what I think you're pointing to as guidance. And so depression and anxiety for me were the sort of way in to a more connected, a more centered sense of who I am. So when I see people taking drugs, it makes me sad, frankly. It's like it's a kind of avoiding the interesting, challenging, wonderful opportunity that we have to really connect with their lives in a deeper, more whole way. It's not to say drugs don't have a value. You know, it's like I know people that have taken drugs as a way to mm-hmm. kind of put out the brush fire so that they can start doing
right.
real work. And I think it has an yeah. enormous value, but if it becomes the only thing that we do, then we're just kind of papering over a deeper problem. And that makes me sad. I think that what I want to see in the world is more people who are deeply connected with what they are and who they are and how they are being in the world. And without that, I think it's a great loss. And so I see drugs, and I also see one of the hugest drugs in our world is just workaholism, and it's a way for people mm-hmm. to avoid the challenge of being connected to their spouses and their lives and whatnot. And that, too, just makes me feel like, what a pity that we're losing the opportunity to be more whole, more complete, more connected human beings. And that's what makes me sad.
And one of the things that you do learn when you're a long-term meditator is that there is something that occurs that you've described very well in your book. In fact, I don't think I've seen it described so well in anything I've read, where you notice that there is you are watching you. Or do you want to describe that a little better than I just did? Because you did a good job in the book.
Yeah, maybe I can do it a little better, and maybe I can read the passage that I think
sure.
you're talking to. The Hindu term for this is witnessing, or sakshi
right.
is the word in Sanskrit, which literally means to watch or to witness. And the passage out of Enlightenment 8, what it's cracked up to be on page 35, it goes like this. I was standing on a porch outside my bedroom. I was in a hotel, so I was standing on a porch, and it said like this. I was leaning against the cool porch railing, feeling the drizzle on my forearms. But there was no extra work in this experience. Witnessing, watching myself do this was utterly effortless. Looking over the misty dunes and the white caps, I was simply conscious that I was looking, feeling, thinking. I was at once a seeing and a separate, silent awakeness. It was that awakeness that was conscious of all this. And being so terribly conscious at that moment, witnessing myself seeing, was astonishingly fresh. I was simply and richly conscious of being there, both looking at the sea and conscious of doing so. How utterly normal, how utterly new. So, yeah, I think that that's, I think a lot of people have had that experience, by the way. It sounds like you have as well.
Yeah, I think that you become aware that there is an observer who's always been there. It's particularly able to be felt when you're very ill. I've had a couple of brushes, pretty serious brushes with serious illness. So I had an opportunity, because I couldn't do much of anything else, being present with that that part of me that is me, that will be me even after I die and was me before I was born, you know. And that also gave me the opportunity to take some advice from that that presence that was very important for me to get well. So, you know, it becomes very much more noticeable when you don't have any of the outside world distractions, because, you know, if you're just sitting in bed and you can't eat, you have to have help to get up to the bathroom, you know, you can't do anything but just be with yourself. And then thoughts sort of drift into your head about what you need to do to get out of this situation, because, you know, you've got to take some action when guided to, in other words. You know, it's
I think you're right. I think a lot of people have had this sort of experience in brushes with death, and I think that the way I'd put that is that what's happened to me in such a when I was seriously ill was that everything else, all my other attachments, just kind of fade away.
Right, exactly.
You are is simply present to who you are, present to what's going on, and it becomes uncomplicated. It becomes simply being aware of being alive, aware of being awake at that moment. And in a certain sense, you kind of carry some of that sense, or at least some people do, carry some of that sense into your ordinary life when you come out of those times.
You
bring a sense of, here I am, and here I'm being aware of who I am, and I think it's a wonderful addition to the human life. Again, it's like what I'm after, and I think what the what Enlightenment A, what it's cracked up to be, is trying to get to is, if we can be deeply honest with ourselves and tell the real truth, that somehow we become more alive to our own life, and that's, I think, what we're actually after, is that sense of being fully in your life as opposed to running from things and running from it.
Right. And in your book, you describe the kind of the isolation that spiritual teachers and spiritual gurus have, and that they don't, they have their relationship with their student or their disciple, but they don't have opportunity sometime to go into the more complicated relationships that most of us have, you know, a marriage, being a boss, being an employee, having a friend, you know, all the things that you talk about in your book are, it's very true. I mean, we've all heard people say that it's easy to be enlightened on the mountain where there's no one around you. It's quite a different thing when you're living with a bunch of assholes who you have to put up with, and you have to,
And of course, that asshole, alas, may be us.
That's right. That's what you said in your book. Oh my goodness, that who I'm fighting with is actually me.
Yeah, how disappointing is that?
I know.
I thought it was all her fault or their fault.
That's right. Hence the psychological term projection, you know.
True. Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, if you think about, I mean, my favorite example of this is a guy like Ramana Maharshi, he dies in the early 50s. And, you know, here was a guy that really never had a relationship. He was a deep man and a wonderful teacher, and I just have all kinds of appreciation for what he was and who he was, mm-hmm. and what he taught. But you also look at a life like that, and we have to say, goodness, this guy never had a relationship. He probably died a virgin. He certainly died unmarried. Mm-hmm. He probably never had a dear friend. And it's like, these kinds of relationships are really where the rubber meets the road. And
it is
easy to say, you know, to be, you know, deeply spiritual when you're all alone. And when you're running the show, imagine how more difficult it becomes when you're saying to yourself, well, the other person actually might be seeing something and saying something that I don't yet see or I don't quite understand mm-hmm. yet. And maybe if you know, like in a marriage, when you're kind of trying to work at a partnership when no one of you is boss, things get really hard. You know, all of this is, I think, where the real spiritual work not begins, but it certainly comes into play. It's certainly been the hardest part of my spiritual path, is learning how to live in a world with other people that sooner or later I disagree with, and yet sooner or later I also have to recognize are certainly as wise and probably wiser than me. So it's in there, it's in relationships that I think things really get interesting and things get important for our own growth as well as for our ability to be in relationships.
Yeah, it's kind of a dichotomy that you have to have a strong ego to do spiritual work. I mean, if you're just a victim and someone who has no ego boundaries, you know, spiritual work, true spiritual work, I'm not talking about just becoming a disciple in India, I'm talking about true spiritual work is difficult. But then at some point, especially when you're with others who are similar to you at similar points in the path, you've got to drop the ego. You've got to, you know, you've got to not have a contest as to who's more enlightened. You know, that's always a good one.
Right, right.
But
I also think that I want to talk about dropping the ego for a second, because this is,
sure.
I think I hear you pointing to the same thing, but I think the language can be confusing, and I know I struggled mm-hmm. with it for a while. I used to think I was after dropping my ego. I don't think I'm after dropping the ego. I don't think mm-hmm. my ego will ever go away, and frankly, I don't want it to go away. I like the mm-hmm. fact that I'm me, and I recognize I'm me, and I like the fact that I'm sort of, you know, I get excited about doing stuff well, and mm-hmm. I think what you're saying, though, is dropping the ego more in the sense of no longer clinging to the impression other people have of you, no longer clinging
right.
to have to be better than everybody else or more important or more famous or richer. It's in there that we drop the sort of attachment, the clinging on to the ego. But we don't lose our ego, at least
no,
the way
don't.
I've come
you're
to,
right.
to this is you don't lose an ego. You don't stop having an ego. It's just you learn to put the ego in its appropriate place. In effect, you become as if vaster, and the ego starts to seem smaller and less
mm-hmm.
important. So it's in that sense this word vastness that I like also mm-hmm. comes into play. Yeah?
And I think that you can tell what's at the forefront. When your ego is at the forefront, you're giving the lecture that you prepared. But when you're other witnesses at the forefront, you can drop your notes and talk on a totally different subject. And you mentioned this in the book.
Yes.
But I noticed the same thing. I went to give a lecture at a Unity church, and the lecture I was going to give, I was waiting to find out what it was, and I was given nothing. And then I get up and, you know, I walk out on the stage, and there's a bunch of people there, and then I end up giving a lecture on psychotherapy, and
yes.
there's like 18 psychotherapists in the audience.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild? I mean,
yeah.
That didn't come from me.
Huh.
I mean,
yeah.
There's no way that I prepared that.
Yeah. You know,
but you see,
I do describe a moment like that where I really just kind of literally left my notes on the chair, and
right.
I got up and I just started to talk from the heart. And I
right.
must say, even since that time, sometimes I'll talk completely from the heart. Sometimes, I don't know, I'm not quite as with it, or I just feel like I'm not confident. And so sometimes
right.
I'll sort of...
Where it's more technical.
Yeah.
For me, it's when it's really
yeah,
technical.
Yeah, when it's more technical. Or frankly,
yeah.
when I'm tired, and I
right.
don't feel quite as
yeah.
creative. So
yeah.
there are times...
Oh, it's the same with me. I can't do
yeah,
it.
I bet. Yeah. And there are times that you want to say, geez, I need my notes here.
Right.
But there are also times where you say, this is... I'm just going to talk to these folks. And
yeah.
I love it when I can really just never look at my notes during the course of a talk and just talk in a connect. It's really when you right. connect with people in the audience that you know mm-hmm. kind of who they are and what they're listening for, and you can kind of see it in the faces. And boy, those talks are so much better, aren't they? I just love them.
They are. They are. And it sounds like you write your books the same way. I've written a couple of books as well, and you know, it just flows. It just flows through. It's not difficult at all. That versus trying to write on a given subject where you have to write it, you know, like a technical paper or something. Yeah. It's just so much more of a pleasure to write when you're just listening, and then I use Dragon Speak. I just speak it into the computer. It's just so much easier. It's like,
I've actually thought of using that. Let me talk about that quality sure. of the book for a second, because I think it's what mm-hmm. you're pointing to. One of the things that I've discovered in my life is that in order for me to bring the depth of my spiritual life into my relationships and into the rest of my life, the key act is in speaking what is the deepest truth for me. Generally, mm-hmm. that deep truth means that I'm saying something that makes me just a little nervous or just a little anxious.
Uncomfortable, yeah.
A little uncomfortable about saying it. And that's a sign that we're sort of getting out of our box and kind of in the same flow as what you get in enlightenment and what you get in the witness state. So that mm-hmm. quality of truth-telling is extremely freeing and extremely, it allows you to feel open and undefended. And what I try to do in this book, more so than anything I've ever written, is I try to sit with the material that I was writing about and speak as truthfully as I could. So the book is a kind of an exercise in truth-telling. It's an exercise mm-hmm. in going beyond the kind of, quote, right answer that we all have and speaking into what is more deeply true for us. And frankly, my whole life is a kind of an attempt to speak truth. It doesn't mean that I'm speaking truth to other people. You know, it doesn't mean I'll say to my wife, "You look fat in that dress," or it doesn't mean I'll say to somebody, "Boy, that was rude of you to talk to me like that." Rather, it's speaking about what's deeply true for me. And that's, I think, my life becomes easier and easier. And I know that the book becomes more and more sort of valid for folks when I tell my truth. It's been very gratifying to hear people say, "Well, my life has been very different than yours, but I could see my own path in your path." Mm-hmm. That's been very gratifying, because it means that you're getting to some sort of core level. And so that when you say it's been easy for me to write the book, I would say there was a great deal of work involved, but the work was always asking myself one question: is this really true, or is this a sort of cute answer?
Right.
And so there's something effortless about telling it, because you know when you're off, mm-hmm. and you know when you're right. telling something that's kind of the cutesy answer. So mm-hmm. so the whole book is a kind of exercise in reaching as deep as I could or can into what really goes on for me and what really goes on in a human spiritual life and in a human life, frankly.
I think irregardless of what culture we grow up in or what religion we're raised in, when we have a significant problem, especially when that problem becomes either psychological or physical, and in my area of expertise in spiritual medicine is more where it becomes physical, you know, when that depression turns inward, lowers your immune system, and you end up more likely to get cancer, that kind of thing. When we have something in our life that's not that is a problem, and we recognize it primarily through anxiety, depression, chronic illness, you know, all sorts of different symptoms, then that's a sign, I think, of some sort of a blockage that needs to be removed. And I think that in your path, you can get to removing that blockage from, you know, from the standpoint of asking yourself, what is it that you need to look at? You know, what illusion do you need to take away, and what truth do you need to put forward? But I would say probably that's a universal path for all of us.
I think so. I'm a little too. I've studied religion too much to say anything is universal, but it certainly, okay. it certainly feels like a kind of universal or kind of pan-human truth. That is, the more deeply honest we can be about what we are unable to say to ourselves, unable to acknowledge in our lives, unwilling to say about what we're doing, I think the more stuck we are. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, I would use exactly the same phrase you are, which is, where are you blocked? And for me, being blocked is I'm unwilling to acknowledge what I wasn't able to do when I was a kid, or what I'm bad at, or what my parents did. Most of us are protective of our parents. Most of us are protective of ourselves. And so that for me, the path has always been, no, really, what's really true here? What am I unwilling to say? What am I unwilling to acknowledge I'm doing? And if I can get to that relevant matter, if I can get down to, oh, I'm doing this to you. I mean, Susan, think about the difference here between my saying to my wife, something I've certainly said, my saying to my wife, you've been mean to me, and my saying to my wife, I've been mean to you.
Right.
I mean, even to say those two sentences, your voice changes, because it's, you know, to say you've been a nasty person to me, just keeps the whole cycle going. Whereas I've been mean to you is both a self-acknowledgement, that is acknowledging to myself, I've been the culprit here, but it's also acknowledging something to her, so it kind of opens up a space in a way that I think is just magic. And so I think blockages are not only internal, but they're also interpersonal. And I think that if we can be very self-aware, that those blockages just sort of start to open up. It's almost like, I mean, one of the images in the book that I like is that, you know, I was looking at a stream, and a stick goes across the stream, and another stick piles on top of it, another stick comes up on top of it, and you see a blockage. And then with a little time and a little luck, the stream will sort of push the first, you know, the whole back gang of sticks away. And then the stream can just flow. And I think that sense of being blocked and not being able to flow, and then just the flow that comes after you've discovered what the blockage was, I mean, those two experiences are just, the difference between those two experiences is just remarkable. And I think, it leads to different physiology. It leads to different immune system stuff. Yeah, all of this gets involved. Absolutely.
I had an experience with the head of the ER at a local hospital. I used to cover six ERs, but this particular ER, the head was more spiritual. He may not have known it, but I knew he was. I could tell. And he comes up to me and whispers and says, Susan, if I don't know what's wrong with somebody, I can run my hand over their body and I can stop right where they have the problem.
Really?
I thought that was great. You know, he knew exactly by the changes in energy over the person's body where the problem was. Because sometimes people come in unconscious, or sometimes babies come in, or I'm sure veterinarians need to get good at this. You know, you need to find out where the problem is. And you can actually do that if you've developed your sense of feeling of blockages within the energy field, which happens naturally when you become a healer.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I also think that for me, and this is the way I think, I've never been oriented around the somatizing of stuff, but I can hear somebody speak almost within a minute and tell you, well, I wouldn't tell them, but, you know, tell you what kind of stuck point they have psychologically. I mean, that's sort of how I think about it. It's a similar kind of thing. Somebody that just walks in your space, you almost instantly can feel, oh, they're really stuck in a certain way here. So,
it's very
powerful stuff.
It's very interesting. When metastatic cancer patients used to come to our clinic from all over the country, still do sometimes, and I would be able to just feel where they had their tumors, and then later on, of course, I get their PET scans, and that's exactly where they were. So we do have this ability. I mean, it's not just me, it's many people who are working with, you know, the physical. You work more with the psychological, so
and there's also a sense of sort of how open somebody is, and I don't know quite how to describe that one, but it's I would say it's a sort of spiritual sense that I've been kind of cultivating. It's not quite the right word, but noticing.
Yeah.
More and more as I've gotten older, that you can sort of see this person is, you know, 2% open, 90% open. There's a sense of somebody, almost as if you can kind of read, it's as if an individual's like a funnel, and you can see how far out they allow that funnel to go. And
they start protecting something.
Yeah, that's right. And how much are they protecting? How open are they? How sort of easy is it? There's a sense, and I think we all know this sense. There's a sense of this person is very easy to be with, and there's a sense of kind of an openness and all that. And other people are very chatty, but not so available, not so easy.
And right.
Kind of closedness, even though they're quite talkative, there's a kind of closed downness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this has to be related to how somebody's physiology works. I mean, I don't think physiology is only that. I think these things are connected. I think obviously, you know, genes and background and eating patterns no doubt plays a role. But for you to be able to sense this is where somebody's blocked, can you connect it with their psyche? Can you say, for example, the person that's quite fixated about food ends up having a stomach cancer? Have you been able to make those?
We've made some very interesting discoveries. First of all, I wanted to say that my mom had her PhD in child psychology, and I actually was in junior high when she got it, so I read all the books she was reading, and I sort of got it with her, you know. So I had an education in psychology early before I ever went to medical school. So I do appreciate psychology from a very, very deep, you know, very early in my education. But I would say that the blockages, let me just give you a religious one, which is very interesting. I had this man come in, his wife kind of drug him in. He had pancreatic cancer. And so I ran my hands over, and then right where his pancreas was, the energy stopped me. And then I get impressions. And my impression, I said to him, I said, you're very upset. And I said, specifically, you're very upset at God for something involving your daughter. And he says, no, I'm not. And of course, his wife says, yes, you are. And what had happened was his daughter had died in a car wreck. Okay. So pancreatic cancer, as you know, is a pretty nasty cancer. It kills people very quickly, and it tends to, you know, just be very nasty. So being mad at God, and this is something that, you know, people are during their lives. I mean, religious people become mad at God on a fairly consistent basis when bad things happen. It is a response. So being mad at God to a great degree, causing a blockage in your solar plexus, I think is associated with pancreatic cancer in some cases. And statistically, if you look at pancreatic cancer, a great number of people with pancreatic cancer develop it within 6 months of their spouse dying. So you could imagine, some of them are mad at God.
Hmm. Yeah, so
that's one example.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, what I see, and this is more sort of intuitive than it is scientific, but what I see is that people that are that have a particular issue around their parents, you know, like the neglected child, you see that playing out over and over and over again in so many different ways. It's almost as if the one key life issue ends up being stamped on pretty much every kind of contact that we have. And I think to be able to get
they have a filter.
To be able to get at those deep pattern issues.
It's very important.
I think is a huge gift to folks, but I think it takes an enormous amount of courage to be able to look at, you know, what are those issues I'm not able to look at, I'm not able to address for myself. So I think this stuff is very subtle, but yet incredibly profound.
It's like a blockage. When, say, a sexual abuse issue occurred when you were a teenager, or even I've been interviewing people for UFO abduction stories. So that's got to be a very, very big violation of your freedom, you know, to be taken aboard these ships and probed, and then, you know, develop these post-traumatic stress situations and not know what they are until you're hypnotized, you know. But all these different things that are, if they're bad enough, what I think happens is you tend not to remember them at all. I mean, you're probably familiar with that, where I think in your book you said you did a little bit with something that happened with your mom. You just didn't remember that a certain thing happened, and it's almost like the worse the incident is, the more we push it down and tend to block it from conscious memory.
And there was a series of incidents that happened with my mom when I was between 10 and 14 or so, and it was fairly abusive. And I think the hardest thing, and I think this is probably true for pretty much everybody I've talked to, the hardest thing is not being able to let the real truth out. Not being able to tell the story, and certainly not being able to tell the story complete enough. For me, and I think this is probably more common than we know, I didn't allow the stories to even come to my own memory. I could not allow myself to remember them because they were dangerous. To remember them would have been too dangerous for my parents and too dangerous especially for my mom. So I kind of shoved it down. And I think a lot of us do that. You take these old memories, you take the traumas, and you shove them away, you shove them down, and then they end up kind of working on you, becoming psychological, becoming physical. Mm-hmm. It's the inability to express what is true, I think, that it leads to that sense of stuckness we were talking about before. So for me, again, and this is where I come out, you know, for me, the willingness, the ability to tell the real truth is always the key act of becoming freer in one's own life. So for me, that's the key kind of curative mode, being able to speak out what is true. Yeah, go.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that if you become stuck in either the victim or the victimizer because you're unwilling to look at your role and what happened, and sometimes they go between the two, which is interesting. You know, they did a survey on bullying, and they found that the children most likely to be bullied also admitted to bullying children. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I think that's fascinating.
So there's a dance around that.
I think it's probably true for all of us. I think all of us, and this is, again, one of those things that's really hard to acknowledge, but I think all of us are in some sense bulliers as well as bullied, you know, bullied kind of people. And I think it may be even harder to say, you know, I've been using my power against that person over there. I've been bullying them in some sense. That is deeply embarrassing to acknowledge that one to ourselves. It's easier to be the victim.
So-and-so's picking on me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Give me pity. I want pity.
Oh, it is very, very true.
Yeah.
So you had some physical sensations that you were able to explain in the book that you actually didn't know what they meant while you were doing your regular meditation.
Yeah.
That you want to describe those? I thought those were very interesting.
This is, I presume, the one early in the book or towards the end of the
book? The back of your neck.
Right. I've been meditating now for about 2.5 years, and I was on a long meditation retreat. And then one day I had this sense, I don't quite know how to describe it. It was almost like there was a little channel or tube in the back of my head on the left side. And I was sitting in meditation, all of a sudden I felt this thing go, and afterwards it was as if there was this sense of openness inside me, but only in one tiny little area. And then 2-4 days later, another tiny little tube went, and that sense of openness now merged with the first tube that had been opened. And in those areas, it was almost as if I had a kind of like a pins and needles quality in that area. And I would never have, very, very faint, I would never have known I'd had a kind of ongoing sensation there until it disappeared. But that's what happened. The sensation, the sense of activity, the sense of noise, like static, just disappeared in that area and never came back. And then it took, I don't know, maybe a month for all these little tubes. And every day, 2-4 days, something like that, I'd have another little tube just go, and so little by little, the back of my neck was turning into this sort of spaciousness, a kind of openness. And nothing else was changing, though. Nothing, you know, I didn't, the quality of my thoughts was the same. I felt the same way. I got hungry or anxious or whatever it was in the same amount, but not in that area. It was this funny quality of being sort of split for that month. And then
it's like an opening was there. There was an opening.
And so I could kind of step over to one side, and I would look at I'd step over to the right, and I'd look over on the left, and it was like, whoa, that was, you know, maybe an inch and a half long, and now two-thirds of my neck. And then I'd sort of step into the side on the right, and it was, I'd get dizzy. It was like huge. And walking down the steps, sometimes I'd feel like I was kind of listing. You know, it's sort of like, because one side felt lighter than the other. Yeah. And then finally, at the end of all that, the last tube now, this is probably a month later, last tube goes, and now things really did change. I had this sense of, I was now this openness in a way that I would not have been able to have guessed before. I was this sense of spaciousness. And it was then that this witnessing came up, because the spaciousness was watching or aware of my thinking process and whatnot. The thing that surprised me, Susan, was that it was not nearly as exciting or neon light-ish, and not life transforming. I was still anxious. I still got depressed. And that surprised me, because I thought, you know, one of these things happens to you and all of a sudden your life is perfect. And my life didn't get to be perfect. It took a long time before things really started to improve. And that was very difficult for me to make sense of, because it was like I'd heard about enlightenment, and this sounded like it, but it wasn't producing anything like the sort of enthusiasm or excitement I thought I was supposed to be experiencing. And eventually I just gave up. I just had no idea what this was. It was too ordinary in a certain sense. It was too everyday-ish. It was too kind of enhanced normal, but it was still normal. It was not that life transformation. And it took a long time for me to come to terms with what this was, what enlightenment actually means, and that's kind of where the book begins. It begins with the struggle of trying to make sense of all this, and trying to make. But I think that was my own particular experience, and I don't want to have people not be able to connect with this, because I think most of us that are on a spiritual path, that have had meditative experiences or prayer experiences, most of us have a similar kind of struggle, which is like, hey, I feel great in my meditation life, but how come I'm still yelling at my wife? You know, I feel great in my meditation life, but how come my shoulders still hurt so badly? You know, I think that all of us struggle with trying to integrate the kind of deeper inner work that we all know and love with this outer everydayness of life. And it's right there that the book begins. And what I'm attempting to do in the book is to say that it is possible to bring these two things together. It is possible to actually integrate what goes on inside with the rest of your life. And that's, of course, I want people to read the book.
Right. I had an experience at a meditation retreat where I felt something turning in one of my ears, literally turning. And then all of a sudden I had what I guess people would call spiritual hearing. I could hear things that were not voices in my head like a psychiatrist might ask about, but a different quality of thought that I had, you know, knew was true, because what I was being told was actually verifiable and verified.
Did that stay with you, by the way? Has that become a permanent?
Yeah, it did. But then later on, I realized that for that to work, I had to not have the monkey mind, the chatter. That's why meditation was important, because the monkey mind, and you describe it very well in your book, the monkey mind's all those discordant thoughts be in the background, not your razor sharp thoughts and your concentration thoughts, but your
the static.
So I realized one day the static wasn't there, because a friend of mine kept asking me, kind of in an annoying way, what are you thinking? What do you think? You know, every 10 minutes, what are you thinking?
Nothing.
That's right. So I realized that in order for me to hear, I'm going to say I think I'm hearing my soul, you know, I think it's a higher guidance, a higher self-guidance, but, you know, that's what I believe it to be. For me to stay connected with that I need to continue my meditation practice and keep my mind clear of monkey chatter. I mean, I think I think you can go backward if you don't, if you get lazy and don't continue meditating.
I have a nice story to tell you here, and I'm noticing also our time is getting close to the end. But
it is, yeah.
The story was this: I was teaching a class, and I'd been meditating now probably 20, 30 years by this time, and Mm-hmm. And I was teaching a class, and a student asked me a question, and I sort of, you know, paused to be, I didn't know the answer immediately, and I kind of paused to be able to answer it, and I realized I was not thinking while I was pausing.
Mm-hmm.
I was just there.
Waiting.
In effect, I was waiting. And then when I spoke, it was like, oh, I didn't know I thought that. You know,
right.
And I didn't know I knew this. And
exactly.
And that was the first time I was able to see, oh, I'm really not thinking anything. And that quality of the lack of monkey mind, I think, is, I think a lot of people have had this experience. But I think it really does indicate that you've been, you know, you're sort of freed up enough that there's not so much in the way now.
My video production company did a video of Ram Dass and a lot of other spiritual leaders when they were here doing conscious aging in Atlanta. And so I was actually there when Ram Dass was being filmed. And the interviewer would ask him a question, and then Ram Dass would be silent. And I could actually see there were eight beings in over him. I saw this with spiritual sight, obviously. But there were eight beings, and then when the energy started to flow into him, he would start to answer the question. And so I was able in that small, that interview, which it was dark in there, because they were, except for the lights on Ram Dass, they were actually filming it. So I was able to see what you were doing in your classroom. You were communing with higher energy to get that answer. And what you bring in, you sometimes don't know. And I'm sure Ram Dass had the same thing. He would say, "Whew, that's a pretty good answer." You know, I didn't know that.
That's right. Yeah. You've been waiting around. Oh, I didn't know that.
That's right. Good. Oh, that's good. I like this.
Yeah. I sometimes
but that's
do that in
fun.
Class. But I sometimes do that in the class where I come out with something I didn't know I thought, then I say to the student, "That was pretty good. Write it down."
Yeah,
say,
really.
What did you say? And I said, "I don't know." You know?
Yeah, and when you're saying it, there's definitely a quality of not being able to remember it. Like if, you know, it's less able to be remembered when you're doing that. So it's good to film it or tape record it or something. But we are getting close to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
I would love to. I've got a couple of things for folks. One is the book itself can be found on the website, Enlightenment 8. Again, the book is called Enlightenment 8, What It's Cracked Up to Be. So the website's called enlightenment8.com. And then in order to, we have a program that teaches people how to reach in and speak what is deeply true and what is deeply so for them. And that website is called godeepertogether.com. And I cordially invite people to sign up there. We'll send them a newsletter about the next programs that we're teaching. And the book is, I'm getting very good feedback for the book, so I'm really hope people pick it up, and I want to thank you for the nice words about the book. And speaking
well,
of that,
I enjoyed it a great deal.
And I also want to say something to you. I think that what you're doing here in doing these interviews is you're attempting to help people find what is deeply real in their lives, and that has both a physiological and a psychological component. And I think the kind of work that you're doing is the kind of work that our society needs. We need people to be more real and more open. And I think that what you're doing is wonderful. And I want to compliment you for doing it, for sticking at it for so long. I know how hard this kind of work can be. And I my hat is off to you for continuing to do it. And you do it very, very well. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, thanks so much for joining us. We've been interviewing Dr. Robert Forman, who is the author of Enlightenment, Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, a book that any spiritual student or seeker should read first, because it's going to help you out a lot. And anybody who's been meditating for a long time, I think you'll enjoy it as well. Thanks so much for joining us, Robert.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Next week, we have Lynn Woodland, Making Miracles, Creating New Realities for Your Life and Our World. That's on the 21st. On the 7th, we have Win Free, The Nature of Positive Interdimensional Communication. On the 14th, Dr. Fatemi, The Episode of Life, Consciousness, Creation, and the Universe. And then on the 28th, Patricia Monaghan, Meditation, The Complete Guide, Techniques from East and West to Calm the Mind, Heal the Body, and Enrich the Spirit. A continuation of the conversation we've had today. Noetic Science will be on Thursday, April 19th. Sandy
Kuta Sauce will be discussing Quest for Inner Consciousness, Unlock Your Greatest Potential. That will be at the Dunwoody office at 7:15. And we have the I Can Do It retreat, which is coming to Atlanta, San Jose, Vancouver, and Toronto. This will be Dr. Wayne Dyer, Louise Hay, Marianne Williamson, and Greg Braden, among others. In Atlanta, it will be in mid-April. If you will go to icandoit.net to find out the dates for a city near you, or call 1-800-654-5126. Well, thanks so much, Robert. I appreciate you joining us, and I hope everybody will join us next week.